Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly news podcast from the editors of the magazine that does not wish that you were paying more taxes. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy Ides of June, everyone.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
This is the first time Peter Suderman has been in the booth with Catherine Mangue Ward for a long time. How's it feeling there?
About 15 months.
About 15
Always
months.
Still much too small.
Where were you, Peter?
I've been in the internet, just sort of like a like one of those AI creatures, like from a Neal Stephenson novel or something, like just the ghost in the machine.
We're going to play with those ghosts in the machine here in a moment. But first, a word from Donors Trust. Is America's fastest growing charitable vehicle safe for libertarians? If you use a donor advised fund, you know all about the great tax savings, flexibility, and privacy that they provide. However, not all fund providers share your libertarian values. In fact, Fidelity Charitable, several other fund providers, have refused to let their clients make grants to several prominent free market organizations, including National Rifle Association, Turning Point USA, state think tanks, and others. Stop using a fund that erects barriers to investing in the causes and freedoms you care about. Roll over your donor-advised fund to Donors Trust. Donors Trust is the national donor-advised fund that shares and honors your values. If you wish to preserve liberty for generations to come, to ensure your son can continue the annual family hunting trip, or make sure your college-bound daughter can defend herself, Donors Trust is the fund for you. You can roll over any pre-existing account in three simple steps or get help starting a new donor-advised account. See how with your free donor prospectus. Go to donorstrust.org/reason. That's donorstrust.org/reason for hooking up with a charitable partner that totally understands you. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Speaking of your hard-earned loot, everywhere you look these days, Democrats are trying to get they honey-stained fingers into more of it. Last week, we talked here about the G7 agreement to try to come up with a floor for global corporate taxes at 15%, while also erecting some new excise tax on the mega super corporate rich as well. Closer to home, though, in ways that affect potentially everybody listening to this, the Biden administration and also Senator Elizabeth Warren, surprise, in separate but kind of parallel maneuvers are suggesting to greatly increase the budget of the IRS. Biden wants to do it by $80 billion over the next decade. Warren's closer to $200 billion. They're doing this in order to close the so-called tax gap, meaning the difference between what the government would like you to pay and things that you legally owe and what you actually do. Warren thinks that we can find an extra $1.75 trillion over the next decade by doing this. Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, has a more modest but still quite insane target of $700 billion. Before we get into some of the privacy shredding aspects of these proposals, Catherine, I wanted to anchor the conversation in some like philosophy, man. So should the federal government be taxing our income?
I like it that we are starting big and then we will drill down to Elizabeth Warren is insane. That's the reason why.
Yes.
Listen, taxes do two things. They raise revenue and they manipulate your behavior. And we've weirdly recently decided that the second thing is more important than the first thing because it doesn't matter if we have revenue, we're going to spend anyhow. So screw it on the revenue. And we're just going to use the IRS to boss people around. And the more we use the tax code for behavioral control, the more we have to empower the IRS to do surveillance and enforcement on behavioral control, which means that a bigger IRS is good for the people that want to do that thing. But it's weird how people talk about spending on the IRS because it's like 80s moms on a diet talking about celery. You know what I mean? Where they're like, oh, like you spend more calories eating it. So it's fine. Like, it's like every dollar we spend on the IRS.
Which, first of all, isn't true. And second of all, even if it were, you just end up eating the celery with peanut butter every
single
time.
First of all,
time.
Celery, well, you got to put the raisins on it too, so you get the ants on a log situation. But
yeah, you know, Matt, the real problem on this podcast is us going off on random old shit. I'm just saying.
It's a metaphor for tax policy.
IRS spending is not, in fact, revenue. And it is bizarre when people act like money spent on the IRS magically turns into 2x, 3x, 10x revenue. Historically, that is not true. Yeah, it's like the multiplier effect, which is also almost always bullshit. And in the meantime, we have generated a huge bureaucracy. In conclusion, taxation is not just theft. It's also bullying. And we are against both.
Nick, you are the anti-anarchist, the strongest one on this podcast.
Sadly.
And you also...
Only because you are so weak, Matt.
That was the implication. Thank you for spelling it out. You are...
Happy to do so.
On the last podcast, last time we gathered here... made the argument, which we have before, that there is a reason to think that we should tax as much as we spend just so that we have an actual consumer taste of it. Doesn't the Gillespie regime require not just an IRS, but an emboldened IRS to get out there? Or do you have some other magical way to come up with the money that we all spend?
Hey, you know what? I read the Bible from time to time, and there's even tax collectors in the Bible.
Oh, yeah, I'm the one who's really on
tangents.
Some
of them became apostles of Jesus. So, you know, taxes and death we'll always have with us. I firmly believe as a techno-transhumanist that we'll probably beat death before we beat taxes. We're going to have an IRS. It's not such a bad thing. One of the things there is no question that the dream, the fantasy of, shaking, hundreds of billions of dollars a year extra out of the tax code is just horseshit. It always has been, and it will lead not to anything other than more kind of invasive, stupid, and arbitrary and capricious rulings by the IRS. I think that's a bad thing. I was looking at a 2019 GAO, Government Accounting Office, Accountability Office testimony by James McTeague, who talked about how one of the main problems with tax compliance is actually the complexity of the tax code. So I would start there. If we want to generate more income out of the tax code, Americans are famously incredibly willing to pay their taxes more than almost any other OECD country. We've got a really high level of tax compliance. Make it easier for people to understand what they owe and to pay it. We go through in a way that is at odds with other developed economies. We do all of these tax expenditures, which is spending through the tax code, going back to something Catherine was talking about. If you just made it easier to say, look, here's a flat rate, this is what you owe, and then what you get back from the government is separate from that, but we would have better tax compliance. But the real issue here, and I was touting up numbers over the past 10 years, as a percentage of GDP, revenues came to 16.6% on average, expenditures 22%. There ain't enough taxation in all of God's green earth to cover that gap. So we have to stop spending as much as we want if we want to have anything like parity or effective government.
Peter, speaking of metaphors involving great works of literature, you wrote memorably once about Medicare whack-a-mole, like the eternal desire or like rhetorical sleight of hand by politicians saying, we're just going to root out waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare. We'll save all the billions of dollars. Are we seeing something similar? And this is not an invitation, by the way, to talk about Medicare, so just don't even think about it. But are we seeing something similar?
I just saw the light go out of Peter's eyes.
What about the Marvel Extended Universe, Matt? Is it also not an invitation to talk about that?
What about the electrodes that I'm going to place on your testicles?
The Medicare Extended Universe.
But is there something similar in this kind of... desire to wring out more tax compliance out of an already, as Nick rightly pointed out, tax compliant set of America.
So I'm trying to think of a metaphor that involves 1980s video game arcades, which is where whack-a-mole was originally played. And you did not, you failed to prohibit me from talking about whack-a-mole. And so my head is like racing through, like, how does this resemble the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game that you could pay $5
for? You know, that Ms. Pac-Man was a real feminist, wasn't she?
I think so much of this is just sort of democratic fantasy economics. And there is a kind of fantasy economics that just exists on the left where you can, like, on the one hand, they're like, well, we don't really need to pay for anything. And on the other hand, they also argue, but of course we can pay for everything and not by taxing you. And they want to hold both of these ideas in their head at the same time, and this is the way they do it, is by saying, look, it doesn't matter. Money isn't real. We can just print a lot of it. We've been printing a lot of it. It's been fine. Don't look at the inflation figures at all. And on the other hand, they're saying, but you know what? We could pay for this. And by we, I mean Jeff Bezos could pay for this. Just him alone, right? Him and his corporate meanness or whatever, right? Like his big corporate tax, like,
you know, by my calculations, if he has one more divorce, you know, in the next year, he could cover most of the deficit. So, you know, there's something.
I mean, and so this is really what is going on, is that Democrats want to be able to say, oh, look, we are in some sense fiscally responsible. And they also want to be able to say no one under $400,000 who makes under $400,000 a year, and this is the thing that Biden has actually said, will pay a dime more in taxes. And it's really, really difficult to increase spending at the level that Biden has proposed and pay for it and not tax anyone who makes less than $400,000 a year. And if you look at the countries that the kind of left socialist adjacent types all say that the United States, well, look, these countries all have these big social welfare programs. They've got health care for everyone, and they give everyone a $20 a week allowance to go play video games at the 1980s arcades that haven't closed yet. There we go. And like all of those countries tax the middle class quite substantially in ways that the United States just doesn't. And if you are making $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 a year, you are running into top marginal tax rates in the 50% or 60% range in many cases in those Nordic and Scandinavian countries. And the Democratic Party is just not willing to say, hey, look, if you are an ordinary middle class earner earning less than $100,000 a year, we expect you to pay an awful lot more for this increase in services, because they know that if they said, hey, look, you have to pay for these government services, the middle class in America would say, nope, we don't want to do that. And so what they're trying to do is say, look, you can have these and they can be free, or at least free as far as you're concerned, because the people who pay for them are big corporations who are nameless and faceless and maybe kind of evil and exceptionally wealthy people. And that's really it.
Catherine, let's go now to the ants on the log. Still have no idea what that means.
I know. What is that, man? Is that a dessert
or a disease?
It's delicious.
The Treasury Department last month unveiled a thing called the American Families Plan Tax Compliance Agenda.
That doesn't sound sinister.
That sounds really good.
Which seeks to create a new quote, comprehensive financial account reporting regime, unquote, that would force a much wider group of financial institutions than currently have to do it to, like, you know, PayPal and settlement platforms and crypto asset exchanges. Their language, not mine.
My God.
They want these institutions to, quote, report gross inflows and outflows on all business and personal accounts, including bank, loan, and investment accounts, unquote. So what could go wrong?
Like literally everything. All the things will go wrong. The IRS has in the past had data leaks, and the IRS knowing basically everyone's big transactions and maybe eventually all the small ones too is not a recipe for personal privacy. many people value privacy. Like, it's not just us crazy libertarians. There are people who like to keep their business their own darn business. And the idea that we might just kind of sweep that away with a quick gesture is genuinely troubling. When you combine that with the recent ProPublica expose, I guess, they got a hold of a bunch of rich people's tax returns. And the way that they presented it was like, aha, we found out that rich people don't pay very much in taxes. But
in income taxes.
Right. So, in fact,
this is an important distinction because, in fact, those people pay an awful lot in taxes.
But they didn't present it
in income taxes.
She might have been making that
point. They didn't present it as like, here's a specific point about taxable income and what rate they pay on it. They just kind of broad brushed it. And like, in fact, what the expose showed was like, the wealthy have lots of non-liquid assets. Like, bum, bum, bum. Like, they figured it out, guys. Like, that's...
Yeah, they're not investing in whiskey.
When they don't turn... All right. When they don't turn their assets into income, they don't get taxed on those assets as income is not, like, a breaking news story. But when you think about how that story went down, about how people broadly misunderstood it, like, that... We will just have lots and lots more of that. The more data the IRS requires reporting on, the more data it has access to, the more leaks there are, sometimes for political gain, sometimes just for funsies or due to incompetence.
Yeah, you know, the biggest takeaway from that story, and Catherine alluded to this, is that the IRS is terrible at actually safeguarding people's
financial
information. I mean, because all of that information came from fucking IRS. It had to have come from the IRS. And so, let's give them more power and more ability to, leak everything.
Like, obviously,
leaked it or it was hacked, right? We don't know which, but
it doesn't
look good for the IRS either way.
Yeah. As someone who has never done anything wrong, I personally have nothing to hide, but I think many people would not like all of their major banking transactions exposed.
Well, it's also, remember the last big time the IRS was in the news, and maybe, this is kind of like a good thing, that it's not in the news all the time because it has largely been defanged in terms of, the ability to do audits or the interest in doing and putting people on that case was, a decade ago when it turned out that the IRS was looking into, in a politically motivated way, was looking into the tax exempt status of various organizations based on keywords that suggested right wing proclivities. The IRS, like all government agencies, is really pretty terrible at most of what it does. And before it gets more money, it should probably, have to show Congress at the very least, if not the American people, that it's more serious about its core functions before, it gets a big raise.
If I'm not mistaken, the ProPublica bombshell, they said they had language to the effect of, we're not exactly sure where this came from, but we're publishing it anyways, which is...
But nobody, there's no question about the accuracy, right?
But I think a very underused concept of using anonymity and using leaks in journalism is explaining, characterizing who and what the leaker was and why they chose to either leak or to remain anonymous. And not knowing that in this case, and also as a journalistic organization saying, well, we don't know, but it looks legit, just strikes me as a pretty weird thing, especially for, a Pulitzer.
I guess I'm not particularly worried about. I mean, because the accuracy doesn't seem to be in question, I'm not too worried about the provenance of this particular leak.
Well, I mean, there was a case during the the Obama administration where suddenly there was a then Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. And I hope I'm doing this correct by memory, like even pronouncing his name. But suddenly people in the White House were saying, well, the Koch brothers haven't paid any taxes. They were talking about pretty specific tax information that they shouldn't have had any access to. And they weren't like referring to some publicly available report. It was strange. And it was in the middle of a news cycle that had something to do with all of it. And I I worry about politicized leaks from institutions that have subpoena rights to your information and is seeking a lot of third-party rights to your information. And Peter, let's turn that into a semi-question or an invitation to kind of reflect on a thing. So a lot of the root of
I'm excited to find out what that thing is.
Yeah. That's great. This is what happens when you listen. You could find out things. So one of the roots of all of the ability for the government to snoop on our stuff is the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970, which was passed. This is the thing that basically forces all banks to rat out their customers if they do something, a transaction of $10,000. And this was done against an atmosphere of worry about the mafia and about
It's
drugs.
All anti-Italian animus.
This was going to be a question
for Nick. I hope
we're
going to talk about Columbus Day, too.
This was going to originally be a question for Nick for all of these obvious reasons, but if he keeps interrupting, he will get no more questions for the rest of this podcast. So there was an interesting Supreme Court decision about this 4 years after it was passed. And the writer of the majority opinion, William Douglas, wrote the following, and this is what I would like you to respond to. So if you're going to start listening, make it now. While an act conferring such broad authority over transactions such as these might well surprise or even shock those who lived in an earlier era, the latter did not live to see the heavy utilization of our domestic banking system by the minions of organized crime, unquote. And that's how he wrote it, too, that thing. Is there a usable lesson lurking there in the way that we justify the Fed snooping into our stuff?
Yeah, we justify it by saying, hey, here's this really terrible thing that's happening, which is organized crime, which was, in fact, in the 1970s and in the decade prior, a real thing. And there were New York mobsters who killed people just kind of because that it was convenient for them to do so. And they left bodies outside of, on the pavement outside of bars in New York. And as a result, we got a law that let the feds snoop into everybody's bank accounts and harass a lot of people for making $9,500 deposits into their bank accounts. Because when it looks like you're trying on purpose to avoid that $10,000 threshold, the banks end up reporting you, the feds end up coming and saying, hey, what are you doing? Because that's structuring. And you're not a gangster. You're not somebody who cuts off heads and leaves them outside of bars in New York in the 1970s. You're just a normal person who happens to, for whatever reason, regularly need to deposit $9,500 in a bank account. And so because we have an actual bad thing, we pass a stupid law that then gets used to harass normal people. And that happens all the time. And we should be worried about that when we pass new laws that are designed to give the feds more power to snoop into people's personal business and to harass them.
Catherine, beginning with the Obama administration, especially, there's been a Washington-led effort to kind of harmonize the world's financial reporting systems so that all financial institutions, or as many as possible, have to cough up data on American citizens back to the IRS. Maybe one day we'll even reciprocate to other countries and give them the information about
never
banks in Miami and Delaware. Clearly, the G7 thing that's going on now is an attempt to kind of further that. Like, let's create this system so that there can't be none of these fancy pants Silicon Valley companies can escape detection and all of this. From just like a pure game theory perspective, does this not push everything in the direction of Bitcoin, blockchain, dark web, fill in the blank, Time magazine scare story from 1996?
Yeah. I mean, the more that you harmonize the world's taxation and regulation at a relatively high level, the more incentive you provide to clever and lightly unscrupulous people, which is basically everyone I know and like, who to find ways to not participate in that harmonized system. But I am so glad you came to me for this question, Matt, because I need to have a word with you about what you wrote about this, which contained the phrase, you could almost hear the sound of the world's political elites rubbing their hands together at visions of like pillowy new billions.
Pillowy billions. Who doesn't like that?
The sound of the visions of the pillowy.
No, it was the sound of their hands as they thought had the visions.
Sound of their hands.
I think that metaphor actually works.
I hate you. What I want to say here is I hate you.
Simone Biles like landing on that.
I hate you and I hope you die is what I want to say. But yes, obviously everyone's going to put all the money in. I mean, not Bitcoin, because that is going to like, as I'm sure Nick can testify from his time in Miami, like there's an important distinction between being genuinely anonymous and untraceable and what Bitcoin is, which is pseudonymous and traceable for important blockchain related reasons. But there are lots of ways to hide your money, and people are always trying to find better ways, and they will escalate that those efforts if taxation rates around the world get higher and tax havens disappear.
Nick, speaking of people who hate me and want me to die, Nick,
I feel strongly about it.
I'm here for you, Matt.
Not just Nick, but the person that I'm going to reference here, Alex Kaczynski, the former Ninth Circuit judge and common Romanian and just brilliant thinker, once, I believe in a recent interview or presentation, had some interesting things to say about the up for grabs element of the Fourth Amendment, especially when it comes to third party providers of whatever, whether it's banking or even speech, telecommunications,
email,
man. And he talks a lot about the notion, the Fourth Amendment notion of a reasonable expectation of privacy, which suggests that's something that's kind of constantly being calibrated. And the example that he gave, which is kind of funny, is that when he saw people having too loud conversations on their cell phone in an airport, he would either tell them to shut the hell up or like otherwise creep them out by like participating in the conversation.
I'm sure he did.
Deep cut. Talk a little bit about the concerns that you might have, or maybe that you don't have, about the way that third parties, not direct parties, but the people that we do business with, are kind of eminently compellable by government to cough up information about us that we don't even know is being tracked.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing, is that not only are, your banks or your email providers, your online storage lockers are not only more easily compelled than you are to cough up stuff, but they are constantly being served with gag orders so that you don't even know if a financial institution or another third-party intermediary is actually complying with stuff, that there's an investigation going on. I find this deeply disturbing. I think, what we're seeing in the Biden administration, and, he's working in the same direction as somebody like Elizabeth Warren, and this is something that you would expect more traditional people on the left to be kind of freaked out by. They want the government to be able to cast a kind of seamless net over everything. But, they're there checking out, they have a surveillance camera on every possible interaction, every possible, thing that you do, anywhere you do, and then they can pick you right up. And, this is, the left, broadly speaking, often, they have empathy for, for people, particularly minorities or poor people who are walking down the street who get harassed by the cops because they're constantly being surveilled to look for whatever. Essentially, that is kind of the vision of a Joe Biden administration or an Elizabeth Warren world, where the government just has immediate access and has notification bells dinging every time anybody does anything that they deem might be a little bit out of the ordinary. And I find that particularly awful coming out of a discussion about tax compliance, because, again, we have a fantastically compliant, series of citizens. People in America are ready, willing, and able to pay their fair share. The rich, in the 2018 tax year, the top 1% of filers paid 40% of income taxes while taking home 21% of adjusted gross income. People are willing to actually pay more than their fair share. So we don't need all of this stuff. So to have this kind of surveillance state, this panopticon, a financial panopticon, coming out of a discussion of, oh, we got to squeeze more money out of the IRS. It's like, get your own house in order and fucking make tax law possible so people know what they're doing. And then also bring spending in line. You know, we are borrowing 29 cents of every dollar, you know, over the past decade. Every, you know, 29 cents of every dollar the government spent was borrowed. Deal with that first.
Nick masterfully teed up a conversation that we're going to have about gag orders in a moment. But first, a word from our friends at BetterHelp. Friends, let's get you happier. As the summertime rolls in, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, existential dread? You can do something about that today. Visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. We're not talking self-help here. This is professional counseling. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what the city of New York is going to need to sort through the absolute mess of its coming Democratic mayoral primary, has helped more than 1 million people take the reins of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month. Other financial aid is also available, even though BetterHelp.com is already more affordable than traditional online counseling services. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and favorite delivery methods, and you'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't jibe with that person, you can swap out for another. Please visit BetterHelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right, Catherine.
No.
I am going to ask you to tie together, like a fine Afghan rug, the delicious irony of two headlines that I'm about ready to read to you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Thank you. First one from September 2017 in Politico. Preet Bharara joins CNN as senior legal analyst. The second one comes from CNN just last week. CNN lawyer describes gag order and secretive process where Justice Department sought reporters' email records. What ties those stories together, Catherine?
That's interesting. Let me see if I can think about that. Preet Bharara gagged us. That's what ties those stories together, and it sucked. So y'all may remember, Reason listeners may remember, a while back, many years ago.
It was not consensual.
It was not the fun kind. And we...
Our safe word is the Constitution.
Oh, it's too early.
What part about safe words do you...
It's too early in the week. Preet Bharara, in his role at the Southern District of New York, requested, and by requested we mean demanded under threat of penalty of law, information about some Reason commenters, and then forbade Reason, a news organization, from talking about the fact that it had done that. Lucky for us, they screwed up their paperwork and it took them a little while to deliver the gag order. So we did have a little gap. But I said no comment into the phone so many times those couple of days while people were calling us because we were gagged and it was illegal for us to talk about it. This is what happened to CNN and has been happening to CNN for months secretly, which we didn't know because they were gagged. And I hope that the CNN green room is awkward as hell. I hope that they are all sitting there together with Preet Bharara just giving him eyeballs about this because he absolutely did this. This is much more common than people might assume. And in fact, CNN even said, we were sort of aware that this happened, but we never thought it could happen to us. Yeah, bro, it could happen to you. It happened to us.
Yeah. From your employee. Nick, a lot of these stories are cast with some understandable reason. The Trump administration, Trump in the middle of 2017, which is where this gag order originated. He ordered a crackdown on leaks. He was upset about the way that there was serial leaks coming from his national security complex, which was tied
from the deep state.
From the deep
Come
state,
on.
Tied to the right. And there's definitely arguments that definitely happened. And so then Attorney General Jeff Sessions said he's going to plug the leaks. We've heard those words before. And so part of the CNN emails that and phone records, is phone logs and email headers and like information regarding it was from June and July of 2017. We also found out that similar things happened to three Washington Post reporters covering roughly around the same time, I think April to July of 2017. And yet, Nick Gillespie, is it not true that the Obama administration prosecuted more leakers than all previous administrations combined. Shouldn't we be taking some bipartisan lessons about all this stuff?
Yeah, we have to. I mean, you know, and again, this is like, you know, this is the essential lesson of WikiLeaks, that a lot of weird stuff goes on and it only comes to light later. The one thing that government can always do to, you know, obviate any problems with this is to actually act, you know, publicly and privately, generally the same way. And then people get less pissed off when all of this stuff comes out. Donald Trump, you know, talked a lot about how Obama prosecuted people and he was a bad guy for all of that kind of stuff, journalists or whatever, or rather, you know, that there were secret goings on and secret investigations. He, of course, did it. Nobody doubts. I mean, Joe Biden was part of the Obama administration. Nobody doubts that Kamala Harris does, you know, isn't running, you know, the California equivalent of Savak or something like that. I mean, none of this will be surprising. What we need is a government that actually acts publicly and privately in a similar way. That's, I don't know. And, you know, and this, you know, the media deserves a bunch of, you know, contempt here because it's always the CNN is always, it's the New York Times, it's the Washington Post, it's et cetera, where they'll be like, oh, well, you know, we didn't expect it to happen to us. Or if we kind of agree, we voted for the guy whose administration is doing this, we're going to downplay it a little bit. It's like, fuck you, you know, like, come on.
Peter, we're at the 50-year anniversary, if I'm not mistaken, of the Pentagon Papers. So there's a lot of commentary that's associated with that and you know, journalistic backpatting as well. Is there something to kind of what Nick was saying and maybe even to what Glenn Greenwald shrilly claims constantly, given that Preet Bharara being on CNN, given John Brennan, you know, former CIA national security guys, all these former deep state guys are ensconced at MSNBC, CNN. Greenwald will say that Democrats objectively love surveillance and the national security state. They just love it. That might be overstated, but is there a tilt in that direction that is sort of illustrated by these factors?
I think it's certainly true that in mainstream political and political media circles, there is a bias towards the security state and its premises, because those people serve as sources. They serve as senior poobahs of various administrations and agencies and offices. And that means you have to deal with them. And that also means that sort of by the rules and logic of the, you know, of sort of official Washington and Northeast power corridor circles, those are the serious people. And the people who are saying, hey, wait a minute, what if the government just didn't dig into people's personal records and didn't attempt to run an always-on surveillance panopticon of everybody and everything that we're doing all the time? The people who say that are treated as the weirdos and the outsiders. And they're very rarely given power. And even when they have power, they're often, you know, in these kind of deputy positions, or maybe they have a sort of senior position for a little while, but they don't get to actually implement the let's take my agency's power away plan, even when they get that job, which is very, very rare, because there's so much pressure to keep those powers in place. Because if you are a lawmaker, if you are someone in the White House, a political appointee, are you really going to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't have access to those records? Let me make it impossible for my people and my team and my staffers and my strategy planning meeting to get that information? Nobody says that. Nobody says, hey, let's make it impossible for me to get to be able to get this information. And as a result,
can I say it's even less than that, though, because nobody is saying that the government should not have the right, if it goes to a court and gets a warrant, You know, there are cases, national security cases, where they have to do secret investigations and things like that. What we're talking about is plainly abuses of the Constitution and even existing statutes. So that you had the Bush administration and you had the Obama administration and it had groups like, you know, the Trump administration, you know, intelligence agencies, you know, the Department of Justice, et cetera, playing fast and loose to kind of peek into people's records without really having any accountability put forth. So we're not even talking about like, oh, you know, we're, you know, these crazy people who don't want the government to be able to find anything out about anybody anywhere. We're talking about, you know, basic, you know, constitutional order that the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, the DOJ, like constantly push against as if, you know, the, we would have stopped 9/11 if only, you know, if only they had more than the absolute powers they already exercise, regardless of constitutional constraints.
I mean, you know, to bring this back to your point, Nick, earlier about the panopticon in terms of financial surveillance, which is where we started this podcast. There is a place or sort of a virtual place in this world where the authorities have perfect interaction about every single transaction, and that is massively multiplayer online video games. And yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you.
But what happens in those games is that, in fact, the authorities are constantly analyzing all the data that they get. And when they see that somebody has developed a strategy that works, you know, sort of in an outsized way, they will often, you know, they will nerf or buff weapons. They will sort of change the game and change the rules because they're in an attempt to keep the people who have figured out a way to sort of to maximize their ability to win the game from being able to do so. And then what happens is those people, the people who are really dedicated to playing the game, they always find a new hack, not like an actual hack of the game, not something that is cheating, but simply a way to work within the rules to be better than everybody else, because the dedicated people always find that way, right? If you are spending 30 or 40 or 70 hours playing, I don't know, Destiny 2 every week, then you are going to know the strategy, the best weapon to have, the best routes to run, the best people to run with. And that is going to be true in the financial surveillance arena as well. You kind of eventually, you can't outsmart the people who just sort of have devoted their life to figuring out how to maximize their gains, which in the game world is, of course, how to play better, but in the world of finance and taxes is how to legally pay the least amount of taxes. And those people will eventually sort of figure out a new strategy. And so there are always these new strategies that develop, and then they percolate down throughout the game so that more ordinary people understand them as well. This is the video game term for this is the meta. And there will be a meta that just sort of that exists for a long period of time, which is kind of this is the dominant strategy until the game makers change the rules. But there are metas in tax policy and in tax payment as well. And if you change the rules, yes, for a little bit of time, there will be a discovery period. Like you will end up in a situation where people don't know what the new best strategy is. But people will find a new best strategy that maybe wasn't anticipated by the rulemakers. In fact, in many cases, was not anticipated by the rulemakers. And it's true, you know, in massively multiplayer online video games, and it's true in the world of tax policy.
There's a reason that Reason used to publish a financial issue.
And it's because people are really interested in
We used to publish the metas.
Let's go to our weekly email of the week, just to be redundant with words.
Is that weekly, Matt?
I believe it's
weekly, like every 7 days?
It's about,
roughly?
Yeah. Please send your queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Andrew Rees, or maybe it's Andrew Rees. I don't know. You guys don't send me pronunciation guides. That's what you're going to get from me. Rees. Says, hi, all. I'm a freelance writer, who can do my work anywhere. Humble brag. And I'm planning on moving in the next year. What's the most libertarian U.S. state? My initial feeling is Nevada or Arizona, but interested in the panel's thoughts on this. Catherine, you're the judge and jury and executioner. Live free or die?
I mean, yeah, you could do that. You could be living that free state life. I'm a DC lifer. Like, I live here in the center of government power and always have. So I'm not the right person to answer this question, to be quite honest. And per our previous discussion, probably a freelance writer who can do his work from anywhere should live in like the Cayman Islands or something and not in the United States at all. But
it's expensive. You live in a cheap place that also has offshore banking. So obviously Macau. You move to Macau.
Yeah. So I'm not your guy, but I vaguely hand wave at the Cayman Islands. That's my answer.
Nick.
By the way, if you want to move to New Hampshire, you will die a little bit every time you buy liquor at a state-owned and run liquor store.
Yeah, and God help you, if, you
free state
project. If you want to.
What
join
are they
the,
waiting for?
Join the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire. Enjoy the Civil War
Libertarian
while it lasts.
Parties.
People. Nick, you've lived all over the real America, the fake America, yeah. Coastal.
Yep.
You've lived in the great Midwestern capital of Columbus, Ohio. No, Oxford, Ohio. You've lived in Death
I
Row.
I lived in the death capital of America, Huntsville, Texas, man.
You've been everywhere, man. What
I have.
What is what is the freest state in the United Estados?
Yeah, well, you know, first off, it's it's a freedom of the mind, man. First off, so like you could be anywhere, and if your mind's not free, you're in chains.
Whoa,
Andrew.
Whoa.
So deal with that first. But girl. Yeah. I spilled bong water all over me now. I don't know. I'm going to put a pitch in for New York City in terms of like, if you want a temporary autonomous zone where you can live however you want, you know what? New York, this is a, you know, and this is one of the paradoxes of freedom, which is that, you know, no city is more regulated, more taxed, more, you know, filled with useless bureaucrats who are getting up in your business for whatever you do. And yet you can also live exactly the life basically that you want because nobody really cares.
Unless you don't have any money. It's kind of hard.
It depends. If you don't have money anywhere, you're in trouble. But it's like, in fact, I see a lot of people without money on the street, Matt, who are living pretty free and fancy. So, I'm just saying this. I'm guessing from Andrew, if he said, Nevada and Arizona sound good, he's somebody who wants low humidity. So go to the desert.
That's true. Peter, what part of Florida should Andrew move
obviously
to?
No part of Florida. I mean, I'm tempted to answer this like a categories question, right? Like it's like the state of outrage or the state of despair or something. Mm. No, I think it's a trick question. States are inherently not libertarian.
Ooh.
Oh, sweet. I would just commend people to look at our, I believe, August 2008 issue. Yeah, contested issue, but regardless, we looked at cities and ranked the 35 most populous cities based mostly on like nanny state type of regulations, alcohol, gambling, freedom of movement, food, tobacco. Sex,
but that's the way to look at it. It's an overall package. If you're going to say like,
I think
what's the cost of living?
I think
literally and figuratively versus the benefits.
Thank you for sticking up for that issue. I think that also taxation, regulation, and other things are things worth looking into. But
I don't know if it was in that issue, Matt Welch, but, when I was living in Huntsville, Texas, I came up with the idea, there's a cost of living and there's a demand for living. And I had tons of money living in, income tax free Texas, 80 miles outside of Houston, half a mile from the busiest death chamber in America. And it was like I wasn't particularly free because I couldn't fucking buy like a ton of the stuff that I wanted to have. So. You can have all the coins in the world and not really be free.
Anyways, go read it. The rankings are kind of fun to look at retrospectively, retroactively, because some stuff has changed. But Miami gets up there. Vegas gets up there in terms of cities, not necessarily states. And Texas was pretty consistent as a place that had the types of cities where humans could move about. Anyways, let's go to our end of podcast. What you have been consuming in the cultural Sphere or Sephiris, depending. That was for Nick. Suderman, why don't you start?
I have been consuming The City of New York, where I spent a long weekend and loved it. Guys, it like people were out. They weren't wearing masks.
Wow, it's such a hidden gem.
I know.
A hot tip from Peter Suderman.
Where is that, in Eastern or Western New York?
It's kind of spread across the both of them. I went there for a sort of a quickly planned long weekend, mini vacation. Went to my favorite bar in the world, Death & Company. Went to the Frick and saw some Vermeers that just kind of blew me away. We spent most of the weekend just walking around and like sort of looking at people being out, and it was delightful. Like the parks were just absolutely packed. We walked through Prospect Park in Brooklyn, and it looked like Woodstock. I mean, there were just so many people out. And there were barely any masks worn anywhere. There was no mask requirement in my hotel. Even some people wearing them. But for the most part, you know, sort of, it wasn't exactly back to normal, but it felt alive and vibrant and fun and lively again in a way that I just haven't felt in any place for more than a year now. And so it was a good time, and there were a bunch of great culinary and cultural experiences as part of it.
New York Times posted a thing over the weekend, so it's probably not true, but that this is the New York summer. The youths have taken over, and they're doing all their youthing all over the place, and they got a lot of pent up youthness. And then it's going to be a big, fun, crazy summer. And I think that's probably true. Nick, what are you doing in the fun, crazy New York summer?
My consumption has been Carol Ross, The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. And it's a very good, very timely book about this, you know, that reminds us of the speed and the rapidity and the arbitrariness of lockdown orders and how they came in and how that affected business, particularly small business, as the title, you know, gives it away. Carol, who is has a great Twitter feed and is a really good kind of financial and business analyst and whatnot, looks at the ways in which people and markets and the economy responded to various kinds of government interventions, which generally were poorly timed and poorly thought through. So I highly recommend the War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. And, it, you know, the real question going forward is, you know, what happens to small business, particularly, and let's say, you know, just lower order entrepreneurship, you know, does this stuff come back? Because there's no question in places like New York, Chicago, LA, a lot of smaller businesses, you know, just disappeared. And whether or not they're going to come back, that remains to be seen. And that's going to be a big, big indicator of whether or not we recover fast or fully.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I watched the first episode of Loki on Disney Plus, and it was pretty good, I have to say. There was a little bit of the, like, I get that the Marvel Universe is rather sprawling now, and they can't assume everyone knows everything, and so there was a little bit of like, gee, we sure have been on some wacky adventures, Loki, and then there was like a bunch of flashbacks just to really quick get you up about what in God's name is going on. Literally, what in God's name?
But it was in show.
It was done
recaps,
in show.
Right?
It was good.
Hey, Loki, let's force you to watch a recap of the Marvel Universe.
Correct. And I, along with Loki, I was forced to watch a recap of the Marvel Universe, and I enjoyed it. The whole, like, I guess spoilers here, so you can, you know, pause your,
it's
skip ahead 30 seconds
episode
if you want, but The Loki drafted into the time cops because he realizes that actually that's where the real power is, and therefore presumably the real potential for mischief is, I assume, going to have some genuinely excellent reason relevant libertarian lessons, and I await them eagerly.
And if it's...
Is he running like an edible arrangements franchise or something? Like what is... Is Loki running a small business? I hope.
No,
or
he's...
What's
he's
he,
not yet.
He's a minor god and he has come across the real power, which is the bureaucrats.
Which is the bureaucrats. He has been labeled as a variant in the sacred time stream or something. And
Too soon.
He is...
Is he the British... The
He's the
Indian,
Delta variant. Yeah,
yeah, he's the Delta. Oh, boy.
I worry after the experiences of both WandaVision and the Falcon and the Snowman, whatever that thing was,
starring Burl Ives.
that they're going to butt up against a very obvious and compelling and interesting idea and avenue of exploration and just absolutely botch it. This could be prisoner level exploration of totalitarian bureaucracy, and they'll probably screw it up, which is sad. But I enjoyed the first episode as well. My what I have been consuming. That's how you spell it, too. As a result of being at a backyard suburban barbecue kind of party this weekend, at which I found myself humming along to a familiar melody, but that was in a reggae thing. And it turns out there's an entire record that is Radiohead's OK Computer, except done reggae and dub. By the Easy Star All Stars, and it's called Radio Dread, and it's great. Yeah, I'm not a big reggae fan at all, but it's really, really good. The Toots and the Maytals are on there doing like good songs off OK Computer. It's a great reminder of like how awesome OK Computer is as a record, but also that it's not necessarily what you want to play like outdoors, swigging down your White Claw, having some nice like reggae jams.
So are you having a white girl summer, Matt Welch?
Oh my God,
it
yes.
Sure sounds like
OMG.
You're yes. Breaking out your old mesh crop tops and everything?
Oh my
and,
God, yeah.
David Lee Roth, you're a... wardrobe,
just yeah, a lot of half shirts, the chaps, we don't even need to say what they don't have, it's just obvious. So yeah, it's
dignity.
The 1987 is back, and
oh,
and dignity is out
short
the window
supply.
Does Radio Dread do any like bleep bloop Radiohead from the later era, or is it all like the mid-90s?
No, it's just OK Computer. It's just OK Computer from beginning to end. The same guys, the Easy Star All Stars, do a dub Side of the Moon. That was their first record in the late 90s. I haven't listened to that. Can't vouch for it. They also do a Sgt. Pepper thing. I don't know what the title is. I'm sure it's hilarious.
I want to hear a ska version of The King of Limbs.
I mean, yeah, no, yes. Who knows? It was surprising to me how good it translated, and also just kind of easier to listen than the weird technological dread of the original record, which is also great and you should listen to. Anyways, that's all the listening that you have to do on this podcast right now. Listen to all of Reason's offerings, including the recent interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesdays. You can find all that stuff at reason.com/podcasts. And that's it. We will see you next week in the in full going hot girl summer. Hot girl summer. Is
that
hot girl
summer.
Nick?
That's what he said. White girl
is it
summer.
Hot girl summer.
But
or
I think
white
it's hot girl
summer.
Yeah. 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 Or Chet Hanks.
People
will
of
tell
all
you it's
races
white
can wear mesh crop
summer.
Tops. Man.
That's true.
Yeah, that's true.
At the Red
and
House.
All genders. All genders as well.
I'm wearing one right now.
He's not. Thank God.
Okay. Goodbye.